I'll do the intro.
Okay.
Hey guys, welcome to Aussie Craft Distillers Shooting the Shit. My name's Craig or Crafty, and I'm here with my good friend
Luke,
and my other friend up in the other corner,
Todd. Yeah.
The Todd. And we are with David Vitale from Starwood. So g'day Dave, how are you?
Good, Crafty. How are you?
Good, mate. Very good. And this has been a long time coming. We've tried to have Dave on a while back, and we had a few technical glitches, and we had a few technical glitches today. So we're running a little bit late, but we're here.
Better late than never.
We're here, and it's I reckon it's time for a whiskey.
Oh, fuck yes.
Sure it is.
Absolutely.
What a day.
It is that time of evening. Where will we start? Todd, what's in your glass? We'll start there.
Well, I'm starting off with a rum and coke using Benson Solander rum.
Nice. Obviously Sydney local.
Yep. New South Wales in there. Yep. All right.
Pretty good.
And then I'll go on to Amber Lane.
Amber Lane Fire.
Okay, that's two New South Waleans.
Beautiful.
All right, and what have we got, Todd? Luke?
We've got we've started off with the new release from Whiskey in Isolation from Justin Farmer. It's a bit hard to read the bottom there. This is the Mullet Over, which is the King Lake in Mulberry Wood, which is interesting. 58% Monster. Very nice, but for my money, I need a little bit of water in it. There's a lot going on there. And then we might move on to the latest Single Malt Whiskey Club. God, fuck, we need to get these people on sponsors. Jesus. I'm promoting that shit every week. The latest Single Malt Whiskey Club release, which is the 36S from Virginia Spirits in South Australia. So we've got Victoria and South Australia.
Right.
Dave.
I'm keeping it local. Glass? Like Todd, starting off with a rum from Jimmy Rum.
Oh, very nice. Yeah.
I had a little bit of giggle on the back because it says what rum can be. And the first back label of Starwood, you know, when we had those screen printed bottles and the black and gold, really old school labels, I had on there, you know, to challenge perceptions of what whiskey can be. That was kind of the tagline down the bottom. So nice to see that it's sort of pervading into the world of rum. It's good.
Nice.
So they're down in Mornington Peninsula. Jimmy's a
good
guy and doing some really good stuff with rum.
Very nice. There's certainly a lot more rum being produced now, isn't there? And I mean, obviously we started, the start of the Australian spirits industry was rum. Then it sort of went away for a little bit, and now we're coming into the rumnaissance. Yeah. We've come out of the ginnaissance, and now we're in the rumnaissance, aren't we?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because I think you could argue of all of the spirits that start off with a base, it's the one that gives you the most amount of flavor from the ground. You know, Crafty, your famous kind of thoughts about terroir, I think, you know, rum has it nailed. If you have a Caribbean rum, it's very, very different to anything we're making. And that's really different to stuff you find from anywhere else in the world as well, right? Like the Dominican Republic and South America and I love rum for that reason. I think it really does kind of, you can, you know, if you know your rums, get really caught up in it all. One of my favorite things about going to Whiskey Life Paris is the rum section upstairs. So if you ever go to Whiskey Live, it's one of the best Whiskey Live Paris. It's one of the best Whiskey Lives in the world. It gets, I'm going to say 20 or 30,000 people in 4 days. Wow. It's huge. Wow. But upstairs is like this rum section that's bigger than most whiskey shows. It's just, you know, traveling upstairs and kind of being, it reminds me of being new to whiskey 25 years ago, you know, just going up there and going, this is a whole world that I don't know about. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, wow. No, that's 20,000 in a show. I mean, that's
4 days.
over four days. It's crazy. It's like bedlam. It's so much fun just to go there and, you know, catch up with a lot of kindred spirits that are doing great things around the world. So it's one of my favorite shows. That and the whiskey.
Have you been there as both a punter and a vendor?
No, always as a supplier. But you know, most of the Starwood team would say that I'm there as a punter, even though I've got a supplier tag on. Because
not staying behind the stand, you're moving around a bit, are you?
Well, I just, you know, I'm bringing people to the stand.
Yeah.
Hang on, I'm just going to be here for a little while.
Yeah. We can't be stuck behind the stand, Crafty. We've got to get out there and get people to come to the stand, right?
Yeah. You've got to get in front. That's what it's about.
I'm definitely exactly. In front.
Yeah.
So what's the very latest in your world, Dave? What are you doing nowadays? Because your life's changed a lot in the last changing, isn't it? In the last few years, you know, after being in the US for a while, then coming back.
I spent 5 years in the States. So we moved there in late 2019, September 2019.
Yeah.
And then in hindsight, that was a good time to move to the States, wasn't it?
Perfect timing. Actually, no, sorry, tell a lie. It was March 2019. We launched in September 2018. So I did 6 months of going backwards and forwards across the Pacific, knowing that we're going to move there and then, like, just situated ourselves in the Pacific Northwest in Seattle. I pounded the pavement of the United States for a good 5 years. Mm. Really interesting place. Let's keep it to whiskey, like a really great place to sell whiskey. You know, surprisingly curious about what's going on in the world of whiskey. And I think the big thing that I learned actually was through that experience was that craft spirits like Starwood do well in markets where there's already an existing craft spirit scene.
Mm.
Right? So take, for example, Seattle, great number of distilleries there. Obviously, you've got Westland. It's owned by Remy Quantro, but also Copperworks, Woodinville up north, doing rye. And so when I turned up to whiskey shows in Seattle, there was no like, what? You know, Australia makes whiskey. It's kind of a little bit of a surprise, but actually they kind of quickly jumped onto thinking about it because, well, Seattle's making whiskey, so why can't Melbourne, right?
Mm.
And the more, if I cast my mind back to like 17 years ago, you know, when we started to think about selling whiskey overseas, it was like, oh, ice to Eskimos and, you know, all of this sort of like, boy, we're really, you know, going to struggle to kind of land a punch here because the incumbents are so good. Bourbon, Scotch, Irish are so good that if you turn up in America trying to compete against bourbon, you're going to struggle. And the truth of it is that was really true for a really long time, but when the local craft spirit scene boomed, we were able to hang on their coattails. And so, you know, we've seen it in Germany, we've seen it in France. The last 5 or 6 years have been a whole heap easier to sell into those markets, not because we've changed anything that we've done, better packaging, all of that stuff, but only because the local craft scene's kind of blossomed.
Do you think it's also helped that you yourself have been on the ground, boots on the ground in the US, being a notoriously difficult market to break into across the board, whether you're in spirits or anything? Do you think it was helped or in some way hindered by you being
It's a complicated answer. So absolutely it helped kind of get me to understand the market way, way more. Mm. But there was some really, and you know, I had to learn very quickly because it's a very ruthless market too, right? Mm. I don't know if I've ever shared this story publicly before, but when we first landed, this is that September 2018, I'd done my research. I kind of knew this is in New York. I knew which bars and restaurants and retailers we should be in. It's like they had a good selection of like Carvalan, some Indian whiskeys, some really good craft spirits. Four Pillars was in there. So I was just like, okay, well, naturally, if they've got that sort of mindset, or like, we're going to be a natural fit for that environment. And I remember the sales guy that we had on the ground saying, look, you know, this particular buyer is known to be really prickly. Like, so I'm just warning you now that it could be a hard meeting. And, you know, with all of my bravado and Aussie charm. Charm is like, oh, I got this. I've heard everything. You know, I've heard everything. I'm unflappable. This is going to be fine. So I went in there and, you know, the sales rep introduced me. This is Dave. Dave, this is John, to protect the innocent. So I introduced myself. Oh, I make Australian whiskey. It's, you know, really well awarded, and we age in. And he goes, I'm just going to stop you right now. David, in the 30 years that I've been running this liquor store, no one has ever asked for Australian whiskey. Nice to meet you. He shook my hand. Now I know who to call. And he turned around and walked off in only a way you can, right? And I was just like, this, holy crap. Like, all of a sudden, I just, you know, realized just how hard this is going to be, because, you know, we assume that, like, off the back of Sullivan's Cove and the great work the Tasmanians did really early on to pave the way of saying we make great whiskey, that then we can hang on those coattails and just go overseas and say, well, I'm Australian, I make great whiskey, it's craft, it's got lots of awards, you know, put me on the shelf. And no, it's not the case. First of all, no one knows we make whiskey. And secondly, since when did an American liquor store lack well-crafted whiskey? You know what I mean?
So how do you change that perception? Or what have you done to try and change that perception of Australian whiskey, and obviously in turn your whiskey?
Besides tenacity.
Yeah. Besides,
Well, you know, the very next thing that I did was got on the Aussie expats in New York Facebook page and said, can everybody do me a favor and call this guy and ask for some Australian whiskey. I went in there about 3 months later and he kind of bailed me up because he said, I know what you did. And I just said, did they buy? He said, yes, they did. Have they come back for more? Yes, they have. And so I said to him, let me try again. He goes, okay. So by that stage, and in fact, now he's one of our best customers in New York. So we've developed a great relationship. But in that first instance, it was like I needed to go in being curious. So it was like, what's selling, was the question I asked. And because he's still a New Yorker, it was bourbon was the answer, right? And I said, well, is it like old heritage bourbon or new bourbon? Like, you know, new riff and like Angel's Envy, which was newer back then, you know. Because no, it's all the antique collection from Buffalo Trace. So again, not you, you know, just trying to be hard about it. I said, oh, your customers like Buffalo Trace and the antique collection from Sazerac. Weeded whiskey. Yeah. I mean, he wouldn't know a weeded whiskey if you poked him in the eye with it, because he's just a retailer, right? He said, yeah, you weeded whiskey. I said, well, this is weeded whiskey. I think your customers will really like it, because that stuff's hard to get and this isn't. And he said, that's better, right? Because all of a sudden, I put myself in his shoes with some of the most expensive real estate in the world. And how is my bottle going to pay rent? Right. And so we've got to get ourselves out of maker's world and into drinker's world when we're selling our product. That's step number one, right? Why does someone need our product? Because, like, last time I checked, whiskey wasn't broken. You know, like, great single malt scotches aren't broken. Irish whiskey's a little bit more broken today. Bourbon, the same thing, right? No one's looking. They're fine. So if we're going to come up, we've got to solve a problem for them. And so all of a sudden, that fact that we're interesting, we've got we can solve a problem for them. And, well, what's the problem? And we solve, well, weeded whiskey is something in America. They love it. Pappy Van Winkle, Weller, Eagle Rare. These are great whiskeys that are all high wheat content bourbons. So leaning into that, because twofold is 60% wheat, was a great opener. You know, and then saying, oh, and by the way, you can get it for under $40, which is unheard of for weeded bourbons. And we age it in wine barrels. And if you haven't gathered from the accent, it's from Australia. We've pivoted it around to being interesting, right? As opposed to, I'm here to sell you some Australian whiskey. It's like, no one's asking for it, mate.
So what came first with the twofold in mind? what came first, the idea of breaking into the US market with a wheated whiskey or producing a sub $100 AUD whiskey for the Australian market?
It was the latter for sure. Like, you've got to win at home.
Yep.
For sure. That's kind of, you know, that was the complicated answer, is that like moving to the States meant that then, you know, I needed to leave Australia behind, and like, we're still not winning at home. Like, you know, that job will never be done, right? For by any brand until we're bigger than Bundy, like, we're not winning at home, right? So, definitely Australia first. And the thing for me was that, like, I just loved, you know, my purview of whiskey was with an E and without an E, American, Scotch, not so much Irish, to be fair. And so, like, when I looked at what, you know, if you think about the inspirations behind Starward, it's not, it wasn't born of that same kind of mindset that happened in Tasmania of like, hey, you know what? We've got all the same sort of features that Scotland has. Why aren't we making whiskey here, right? Like malted barley, great waters, highland, peat bogs, you know, that quintessential Tasmanian story, which is lovely, right? Yeah. Great origin for the industry because it gave us belief early on. But for me, I didn't need to prove that we could make great whiskey, right? Like, that had already been done. For Starward, it was to get it off the top shelf and something that you can drink every day, you know, that like... And then the challenge with that is, well, if you've got a drinks card at home, not us because we're whiskey geeks, but if you're just a regular punter with a drinks card at home and you've got a bourbon, Scotch and Irish already there, then I can't just be an Australian whiskey that does it the Irish, bourbon and Scotch way. I've got to do it the Australian way. And so that was kind of the starting point of like, well, what do we then do? It's like, well, we grow a lot of wheat here and, you know, that's got to be part of the story. And I know from an American perspective that they make approachable, easier drinking whiskeys. You know, the big difference, you know, I love these. Well, let me go back a step. There's five inspirations for Starward as a whiskey. Johnny Walker Black, Belvenny Doublewood, Lagavulin. Maker's Mark and Wild Turkey.
Right. Okay.
And I think that they serve, now, if you blended those whiskies together, that would be the quintessential definition of Frankenstein whiskey, right? Like, it just didn't work, right? But that's not the point.
So it wasn't about eclectic collection there.
But it's not about the flavors of those whiskies. It was what they did for whiskey, right? So Johnny Walker Black, you know, I've had whiskey, had the privilege of drinking Johnny Walker from the 60s, 70s, 90s, noughties, and today. Like, and you can thread a needle through that stuff, right? Like, such is this consistency of that product.
Yeah.
It's changed. Of course, it's changed over time, but you still recognize it as Johnny Walker Black. And so for me, the first thing that we wanted to deliver on was consistency. You know, up until that point in time, really a lot of the Tasmanian whiskey industry and Bakery Hill and Lime Burners, that was it, right? The Tassies, Bakery Hill, Lime Burners and Starward, we were number 10, I think. Up until then, they're all small batch single cask whiskies, which are bloody amazing. And I worked at Lark in all sorts of roles. And, you know, if someone didn't leave with three bottles, I hadn't done my job properly if I was at the cellar door, right? And that was the magic of it. It was like, you can have a pork cask, you can have a cherry cask, you can have a bourbon cask, you can have this, we don't even know what a cask it is, but it's bloody delicious, right? That's great when you're hand selling. But if you want to be in every self-respecting bar around the world, if you want to be, if you want it to be able to sell itself on shelves, it's got to be consistent because, you know, the tasting notes that someone reads have got to be what's in the bottle. And so for me, the benchmark of consistency was that Johnny Walker. So that was the first inspiration. Belvenny Doublewood was my gateway single malt, so it was always part of the mix. You know, and
it is a classic dram.
Classic, right? I mean, it's the quintessential, you know, if there's such thing as perfection in a single malt, that would be it for me. It just does everything that it does really well. But, whiskey is so emotive at the end of the day too, right? I'm sure each of us have got our own version of what a perfect single malt is. But it was just a moment, you know, discovering single malt for the very first time with Belvenny Doublewood is a moment that I'll never forget. And, you know, what a wonderful brand as well, right? Like if you just think about the storytelling behind it, the, you know, secondary aging and, you know, finishing casks and Dave Stewart being there for 50 years and the epitome of craft, that's kind of what they call, you know, think of themselves. So as consistent as Johnny Walker, as well-crafted as Belvenny Doublewood, my middle daughter's name's Isla, so I'm a bit of a peat freak. And so as distinctive as peated whiskies, right? You know, 40 paces away, you crack the cork on an Ardbeg, you know it's an Ardbeg, or you know it's peated, right?
Yeah.
So what I wanted on the shelf in that sharing cabinet or on the drinks cart at home was something that was distinctively Australian, that like maybe not as like an acquired taste as peat is to drinkers, right? As distinctive as peat is to Scotch, I wanted something as distinctive for us. And hence why we always chose red wine barrels to age our whiskey, right? Because it's distinctively Australian. Like if you've got a bourbon, Scotch, Irish, Japanese, and Starwood in a lineup, and you say, okay, tell me which one's the Australian whiskey. Well, it's that one. It's aged in wine barrels. Now, other countries do it, don't get me wrong, but like we have a moral kind of high ground to stand on in that, like these wineries are a day's drive away from the distilleries, right? We can empty them in the night and fill them wet in the morning, right? You can't do that in Taiwan. You can't do that in Israel. You can't do that in Wales. You definitely can't do that in France. Or sorry, in Spain. You can do it in France, right? But we've just got that wonderful ability to kind of own that story in a way that others can't. And that was really important for me. As distinctive as peat is to Scotch, I wanted whatever we were doing to be as distinctive for us. So that's why we kind of committed to red wine barrels. As easy to drink.
And that worked for you very early on with it being labeled as Starwood red wine cask. On the label, very front and center. But then you pivoted that brand to the more sort of star celestial brand, if you will, of Nova. What sort of prompted that shift? Was it just a branding shift or was it a...
Yeah, I guess...
Yeah, how did that come about? Because when you said that red wine was... is such an identity thing for you, it was then taken away in off the front of the label.
Yeah, it's well, it was there, but yeah, very in seven smaller. Point.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, we made a mistake, you know. We made a mistake. It's simple. And you'll see now on our new labels, like this is shameless plug, 100 proof here, right?
Yep.
So like single malt whiskey aged in American oak red wine barrels.
Right.
And in fact, in the US, it says for 3 Melbourne years as well.
3 Melbourne years.
Yes. So we're kind of leaning into provenance, but in our own way, and turning what used to be a disadvantage, it's young whiskey, into something that we celebrate.
Yeah.
And qualifying it with a Melbourne year provokes the question, what is a Melbourne year?
What is a Melbourne year?
Yeah. Well, let me tell you what a Melbourne year is. Four seasons in a day and off we go, right? All of a sudden it was like, what is a Melbourne year? People pick up the bottle, read the back and go, oh, makes sense. You know, and then all of a sudden age became less of an issue.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So, you know, Maker's Mark, high wheat bourbon, easy drinking. Right, great value for money. Talked about premium before premium was a thing. The wax seal, different bottle shape, definitely a step up from Jim and Jack in terms of price point. I'm talking in the 70s. And then you got Wild Turkey, which is like iconoclastic, you know. So those were the five inspirations. So consistent like Johnny Walker, well crafted like Belvenny, distinctive like peat is to Scotch, easy drinking, and maybe one day as iconic as Wild Turkey. The great thing about those five is that I can say to you, Crafty, use that as your inspiration to move forward, and off you go. It's not, you're not copying Starwood, right? They're just really good touch points to have as a brand to kind of go out there and have a reason to exist. Because when you can kind of turn up and say, in a bar in Texas, you got great whiskeys behind here, I love them all, but you know what you don't have is something like mine, because it's aged in wine barrels. It's fucking delicious and really affordable, and I think your customers would enjoy it. All of a sudden, it opens up a conversation. If I turned up doing what customers expected us to do back in 2007, which was like make a single malt whiskey aged in sherry barrels, it's like, what am I saying to these people? They're going to be like, you know what? I'm good. Nothing wrong with Macallan. Nothing wrong with Glenfarclas. Oh, but it's Australian. Who cares?
Yeah.
Nothing broken with Scotch, right? And that's what we've got to understand about the market is that, you know, this is not, we're not Uber and the incumbents at taxis. Right? When Uber arrived, it's like, oh my God, where has this been all of my life? I can see where the car is. I know how much I'm going to pay. I can rate them, all these sorts of things, right? Now it's like, it's kind of like Uber already existed and we want to be another car service, Didi. Right? So there's nothing broken with whiskey and we're trying to come as a new industry to turn up. We better be bloody interesting. Otherwise, talking about, and I just wrote an article about this, talking about awards. I mean, we need it. Whiskey needs it. It's part of the mindset of drinkers is like, is this any good? Yeah, it's good. But it's not enough to get them to stick because I've already got good whiskey at home.
Just on the wet red wine casks. So that was, in its day, that was something quite new, a bit unproven. What gave you the confidence to go down that line, or was it a leap of faith initially?
It was a leap of faith. It was genuinely, I bet the farm on that idea. You know, and if it didn't work, we would have been bankrupt because we didn't have enough whiskey.
That is a leap.
We didn't have any, well, you know, I mean, we were 90 days away from insolvency for the better part of 3 years, right? So, you know, there, but for the grace of God, but yeah, that would have been cataclysmic. Like we bet, and it was just this, here was my hypothesis back then. Like everybody thought I was crazy. You know who, right? Like I was number 10. You can imagine who the 9 before me were. Everyone thought I was crazy aging in wet barrels. Whiskey barrels need to be shaved, toasted and recharred, or ex-bourbon barrels, right? They need that oak, that fire to kind of caramelize the tannins and lignins and preserve the flavor and do all those sorts of things. And my kind of thinking on that was, well, what you know, if we go to the why is fire so important? If you think of a brand new American oak barrel that's charred, you know, if you've had a virgin oak barrel whiskey and then a charred barrel whiskey, I, you know, personally prefer the charred barrel because like the other one's just astringent and full of tannins and tannins are just too overbearing, right?
Too much, yeah.
My hypothesis, which proved to be true, is that I think all the tannins that are going to create that astringency are in the wine. That's why winemakers use the barrel. So traditionally, we soften those tannins and lignans by charring the barrel. My hypothesis was like the barrel is softened by the extraction of those tannins into the wine. And then what we're actually left with is a soft, semi-virgin, if there's such a thing, oak barrel.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Because all of that astringency has been taken out. That's why we use wine. Right? Well, that's why we use barrels for wine, right? So that was my hypothesis, but unproven. 6 months in, strawberries and cream, I'm high-fiving everybody, thinking this is great. 18 months in, I'm thinking I better start dusting off my resume and explaining to investors why we don't have a product anymore and or a business anymore. And then, you know, like by about 2.5 years, it was just like bang on. And we were really lucky, that we source these barrels from Yolumba
mm-hmm.
to start off with. So the very first casks that we used to age Starwood in red wine barrels were octaves from Yolumba that have got their previous wine barrels. And we were lucky because Yolumba has their own cooperage at the winery, one of the very few winemakers in the world, family-run winemakers that have a cooperage on site. And so that was complete arse from my perspective. I didn't know anything. I just thought it's good wine. It'll make good whiskey. Yeah.
Lovely, jubbly.
Not true, right? Like, it's always the case that way, but not every $100 wine barrel or $100 wine that's seen oak makes $100 whiskey.
Yeah.
And I buy a case of the wine, no problems, for $100 a bottle, but I'm not touching the barrels. So we were just really lucky that we got these small casks that had unbelievably good wine in them that were coopered with love and care in Australia, and that I could go back to the cooperage and say, Jock, barrel 2 and 3 both have 2010 on the side of them, and they both say American oak, but one tastes completely different to the other, and I put the same spirit in each of them. What happened? And I know they're all old vine Shiraz. What happened? And he'll go, oh, yeah, well, barrel 3 was like a leftover barrel from the year before, so it had an extra year to air dry, you know? I could kind of learn more about the wood policy of the winemaker because I had that intimate relationship with them, which enabled us to kind of accelerate more of this type of barrel, less of that type of barrel. So that was luck, sheer ass, but the origin of the idea was born of this thought that we use charred barrels because they've softened the oak, and I think the oak is going to be soft by the fact that it's had red wine in it.
There you go. And proven right.
Yeah, which is nice. It's kind of like a lovely kind of feeling. But geez, you know, for a few years there, it was like white-knuckled.
Yeah. So obviously it's, in saying that it's been a white-knuckle ride for a few years until you get the reputation, you've got the stock, you're putting out the releases, you've got the brand, and you're, at that point, are you moving into the US or are you still focused in Australia?
We'd already kind of won a few San Francisco World Spirits competitions, IWSC, things like that. So we knew we had good liquid. We knew we could afford to make it at a price that would resonate with an American drinker. Like, to put this into context, we were cheaper than Westwood was in America.
Wow. So that's really interesting because obviously excise here is fucking huge. Mm-hmm. Sorry, there's a mozzie buzzing around us here. I'm going to kill the fucker as soon as I see him. You've bitten me twice already.
Just keep drinking whiskey.
Yeah. So what was I saying? So price point, here in Australia, you are like the majority, looking at the shop page on the website at the moment on my second monitor here, there are the majority of the spirits you've got a sub 100.
Yeah.
Even personalizing it, it's only just over 100
or
under 150.
Yep.
Now, given, and they're 700 mil bottles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given that a good chunk of that price there is excise.
Yeah.
How the fuck do you end up cheaper than Westland or Westwood in the US?
Both, actually.
How on earth does that happen?
Yeah, look, you know, let's break it down. What goes into making a bottle of whiskey? Without the emotion, Crafty, what goes into making a bottle of whiskey apart from blood, sweat, and tears?
Barley.
Commodity.
Yeah.
Oak. Barrel. Commodity. Right. And energy. Commodity. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it is totally geared at its basic, and this is dispassionate, right? You know, you won't find a more passionate distiller. I'll arm wrestle Crafty for that title. You won't find a more passionate distiller. Like, I love what we do. I'm really proud of how we do it. And, you know, we don't cut any corners. But at the end of the day, distillation is a scale business. And the more you make, the cheaper per liter it is to make, because you're covering all of the costs of people, the roof over its head, the insurance, all that sort of stuff gets spread over way more products than you have, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I made way more. So in our first year of production, I think we eclipsed the whole Tasmanian whiskey industry under bond. That was in 2010.
Wow.
I'd made in 1 year in 2010. This is before Distill Ventures, 4 years, 5 years before Distill Ventures, right? I'd made more than Tasmania had in bond in 1 year with the same two pairs of stills that Bill and Lynn had, right? Because I just worked them hard. They were like, oh, 3 days a week, that's enough. It's like, no, that's like, we're going to sweat these assets. Like 7 days a week, three production runs a day.
Wow.
And Bill was like, you can't do it. And I said, yes, you can. So what we did, he said, there's just not enough time in the day. And the argument was that, you know, and this is a well-established fact, and Jim McEwan's kind of famous for saying that, you know, trickle distillation is part of the romance, and, you know, capturing the flavonoids in the in the spirit is a really key part of that slow distillation into the spirit receiver. We do not need to give any fucks about the fours and faints in that conversation, because they're going back through the still.
Yeah, right.
So what I did was, I was at an airport when we first started. One thing that an airport has an abundance of is electricity coming into it, because they don't want to, like, three grids in an airport.
Yeah.
And we were an old Qantas maintenance hangar, and it had a crane that could basically lift an engine, right? So I had 600 amps coming into the building. Like, it was ridiculous, right? This is like 20 houses worth of, like, you got it.
Got
well
it.
Done. Mr. Miyagi over here.
Yeah.
I had 600 amps of power coming into the building, right?
Oh, so
we had no short supply of energy. And so all I did was supercharged the heating up of the stills.
Yeah.
Then when we got to, like, heart, I slowed it down to bill rate. And then when we got to faints, I supercharged them again.
Right.
And we're able to get enough. Now, that got me two runs a day. Do 2.5 runs, but the third run was because we were running hot. Basically, what I got was all of the spent ale, pot ale.
Yeah, yeah.
Put it into a tank, and then run it through a plate heat exchanger to charge the wash still with the next run. So we started the stills with the wash being at 60 degrees Celsius.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
Yeah. Wow. Yep.
Because we were continuously running. So not only did we save money, that was the that was great, not to diminish that and carbon and all that sort of stuff, but it was actually time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I could squeeze it up.
One of your biggest time sinks is heating the still. How long does it take to heat your still?
It takes me 3 hours, yeah.
3 hours to heat the still.
Yep.
Well, we were up in 45 minutes on the wash still.
Wow. Jesus.
Right? Because it started at 60 degrees. It starts at 60, you know, went in at 60, and by, you know, when are we collecting? 80 degrees, 82?
Yeah.
So the delta was really short with an abundance of power in the wash still. So we were just able to, you know, so it was just applying a very, like, engineered approach while still caring for the spirit mindset to it. And then all of a sudden, like I said, those two stills made just a smidge over 100,000 lels in our first year. And then we just ran them hard, like as hard as we possibly could, until, you know, I can say it now, it's been more than 7 years, ran out of money, and then just had to deal with that sort of pain point and got to market, fortunately, with the benevolence of patient investors and people that, you know, were happy to punch me in the nose but not kill me, because then they'd never get their money back. And then we got there, and, you know, the good news is that all of those investors got every cent that they were owed to the day that they were owed it, right? Like, and there was never any doubt in my mind that that would happen. But well, it got pretty hairy there, because I naively thought I just needed to get to market and then all of my problems will go away because I've got something to sell. But actually, you know, the hardest part of distilling is selling the product.
Yeah.
Even today, right? Like, you know, and this is kind of the thing. Still white knuckles, mate. Just more zeros.
So how did you start? So when you did go to market, how did you first, how did you move the first bottles?
So,
because at that point, I imagine you're at a scale that doing your local farmers markets is nowhere near enough.
Yeah.
How did you get those bottles?
This is, this is where we're really lucky, right? So this is when did I first met South Trade in January 20th. I know exactly the day it was, January 20th, 2010, which is the day the still ran for the very first time. That's the first meeting I had with them. So we're coming up to working with them for 15 years next January.
Right? Wow.
That was a clear 3 years before we'd even actually sold our first drop. So they were part of the conversation very early on. I wanted them to be our distributor. And I just, you know, that was at a time when South Trade had Brook Laddie, the Remy portfolio. No, they didn't have the Remy portfolio. They just had Brook Laddie and the Botanist Gin, and they had Sazerac, Old Pulteney, I'm guessing, and some independent bottling, right, stuff. That was it. And then I came along and said, I want to be part of the portfolio. And, you know, despite my failure of convincing that New Yorker that Australian whiskey is going to be a thing, fortunately, my charm and, you know, confidence gave optimism to those, the owners of the of South Trade at that point in time to back the idea. So we worked together. They were always in the background, worked together to kind of say, okay, how are we going to come to market? What is it that we're going to do that's different? Why do we have permission to exist? Stress testing these ideas that I've got. And, you know, without their support, I wouldn't be here today, without a lot of people's support. And that was kind of the thing that I knew very early on, having worked in Tasmania, was that, like, the business that I was setting up was a very different one than the one that had already been established in those distilleries, and that, like, I couldn't do it on my own. There was never going to be a way of doing this on my own, right? I needed to raise capital. I needed to have business partners like South Trade that sort of understood where I was going to take the brand. And then obviously later on in 2015, we worked with, you know, we worked with Distill Ventures to kind of get the business off the ground. So, but that was 8 years, right? The first 8 years of Starwood were no different to everybody else around this table now, right? Like, it was just like bootstrapping it, believing that we're going to do it, but like with a metric dick load of whiskey that I didn't know how to home yet, but believed it would. Wow.
So how much, do you know how much you've got in bond now?
Not enough is the answer. Smart ass answer. No, there'd be, look, I don't know exactly, but it'd be over 20,000 barrels.
Wow. Ooh. I mean, the costs alone in storing that, it'd just be.
Yeah. Yeah.
No wonder you need a bloody hangar.
Yeah, the exciting thing is that we're not alone anymore, right? Like, you've got Will Edwards doing his Archie Rose thing. We've got Callington Mill down south. I think Lark is starting to scale up some more on Sullivan's COVID, getting one more still. that wasn't a dig. It's just like, I still don't.
Yeah.
It's confusing more than anything.
Well, when you can sell a single bottle for $300-$400.
They've got plenty of margin there to go and buy another still.
Yeah.
Two more, in fact. But anyway, we digress. So the great thing is that we're not alone anymore. Oh, here in Melbourne, the gospel. You know, there's plenty of whiskey now, apparently of great quality Australian whiskey that we can take to the world at scale, which is really exciting because the category of one doesn't work.
You know, so when you're over in the US, or you're over jet setting around the world, have you noticed any other brands that are there on the shelf, Aussie brands that you've come across and didn't expect?
Randomly. You know what I mean? Like, it'd be random, kind of like, huh. So Tin Shed did something, like Schmitty did something that was like, oh, this is nice to see. Obviously, every now and then there'd be this sort of like random bottle of like $800 Sullivan's Cove that It'd be $800, but that's another conversation for another day. Yeah. You know, and the problem with that was like, oh, Australian whiskey, no one wants it. It's too expensive. It's like, no. You know, we're not that, you know. So, in fact, the weird thing was that sometimes we kind of shot ourselves in the foot of like being so expensive and so unattainable and so rarefied that it then made the job harder. And, you know, even in Australia when we first started, a lot of people who shall remain unnamed, but oh, sorry, my lights just went out. What am I doing here? Jesus Christ, I'll stop fidgeting. That's an omen. Maybe I shouldn't talk about this. You're like, you're too cheap. You're doing a disservice to the Australian craft spirits industry because you're too cheap. And my first product, Solera, that we launched was actually at the same price as Belveni Double Wood. Because in good conscience, and this comes back to nothing's broken, I could not eyeball someone and say you should pay more for my product than you should Belveni Double Wood. Because given the option, buy Belveni. Is there something wrong with Belveni that I'm not aware of? You know what I'm trying to say? Like, if we're looking for a trade single malt whiskey, what's wrong with Belveni? And so that was my benchmark. And so when we launched Solera, it was price pegged to Belveni Double Wood. $75 a bottle. Seven times change, right? And so that's where we launched. Yeah. And everyone's it's too cheap, and it's like, well, I can't in good conscience kind of ask more for my whiskey than Belveni asks for theirs, knowing how good Belveni Double Wood is. Because the argument, is the argument of like, but it costs me more to make, zero fucks given by the drinker.
Yeah,
I see what you're saying.
Right,
it's like, I like you. I'm gonna buy a bottle because you're a mate. Sure, I've met you. I'm buying a bottle as a memory of my visit to Tasmania. Sure, I'm buying you to put on my shelf, and I'm going to pay double the price. I'll stick with what I got. Thanks.
And I'll probably buy one of you
once, right? Yeah. So a lot of the you know, and this is kind of the challenges the industry faces, right? Like if you know, I don't want anybody to think that like I'm saying that like the approach of being small scale is wrong, but you're selling a different product, right? Whiskey is the medium by which you're selling a memory of an experience. I came to visit Crafty's distillery. I didn't even know there was a distillery. I was at the pub drinking with this guy that wouldn't stop talking, and lo and behold, he owns a distillery.
He just happens to be down the back.
Yeah.
Right. And then he took me around back. I mean, that's magical, right? Yeah. And if you can, if you, you know, then you can charge anything for that because you're just selling an experience. You're selling a memory, right? But if you're there to like, if we're there to kind of be on the sharing cabinet at home, if we're there to be on a drinks trolley and being like, what peated whiskey is to Scotch for Australia, we've got to compete against those products because they're bloody good, right? And so that was my argument, and we made no money. I made $0, right? And hence why it was harder to sell than it was to make, right? For the first 3 years. But the whole point of it was to prove that people would buy a whiskey, an Australian whiskey that was distinctive, that was well-crafted, consistent, had a reason to be there, right, on the shelf for $75, and then scale would take care of the rest.
Well, certainly you are on my dad's shelf. The Twofold is his regular. Dad and I, we both got into whiskey about the same time. We went through Whiskey Loot, and we get every month the shipment of three different whiskeys from all around the world, and we fucking loved it, absolutely loved it, until we tasted everything that they had to offer. And they started from the beginning. So at that point, we stopped. And we were both really very interested to see what Twofold had to offer because we loved the wine cask. Absolutely loved that. That was one of our favorites for quite a while, given that it was at a great price point and it tasted fucking fantastic. Then Twofold came out, and Dad and I sort of looked at each other and went, this could either be really good or it could be really shit.
Mm.
And now it's on his shelf all the time. As a price conscious, consistency seeking whiskey drinker.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, and of course, they're all my kids. I love them a lot. They all look beautiful, right?
Yep.
Having said that, we've had a lot of American retailers come to us and say, you should think about putting your price up.
Mm-hmm.
Who says that, right? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Wow. And because the challenge is in the States, as you know, and I mean, obviously in Australia, we're in the Australian whiskey section, but people have, if you're walking to the Australian whiskey aisle now, right, if you're going to the aisle, then you have some sort of understanding that Australian whiskey exists and that, like, whether it's from Tasmania, Melbourne, Sydney, wherever it is, WA, it's 101. But if you're doing that in a retailer in the United States, there's no Australian whiskey section, there's just rest of world. And it's dominated by Japanese whiskey, all of which is double, sometimes three times the price of Twofold.
Yeah, wow.
So when they see all of those products there at that price and then Starwood at our price, they go, that must be shit. Perversely, if Starwood was in the bourbon section, right, it's like, what? Like, this is unbelievable. An Australian bourbon, which can't be, obviously, but, like an Australian whiskey for, like, $40. Wow, this is great. Weeded, 90 proof, like, ship it in, right? So it's all about perception when you're not there and have zero awareness of the brand, that you're just going to kind of like shop with your eyes. The packaging needs to do a lot of the heavy lifting, which it does now particularly, but also price is an interesting signal about quality, regardless of how much we know, it doesn't really matter. The greatest example of that is we're huge fans of Ichiro's grain and malt at the distillery. It was part of our kind of mindset around Twofold very early on. And that's like $100. So it's, what's that, 150 Aussie?
Yeah, thereabouts, yeah.
And a lot of people in blind tastings would go, I would drink Twofold every day, putting price to one side. Like, this is not with me in the room or anything. It's like blind tastings, but like that this is as good a product, if not better than Ichiro's grain and malt, which is a huge compliment. Huge compliment.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and that's $100 whiskey. So we could make it more expensive, but then the ambition that I have is a whiskey that like wanted to be in the everybody's sharing cabinet wouldn't exist, right?
Yeah. So an interesting question has come through from the audience, from Lord Smeg, one of our regulars.
Yeah.
So it's obviously a brand looking at the overseas market for expansion, but domestically, how do you plan to address the rise of, say, Ned when it comes to mid-price licensed on-premise sales?
Great question. So this is a really, really, really simple answer. Starwood is not instead of another Australian whiskey. Starwood is instead of bourbon, Scotch, Irish, right? Japanese whiskey. Starwood is instead of beer and wine when we mix it, right? In the 60s and 70s, Americans drank more Scotch than they did bourbon. And now it's like maybe 4-1 the other way.
Yeah.
So there's every likelihood that if we keep doing what we're doing as an industry, that one day Australians will drink their domestic spirit just like Americans drink their domestic whiskey.
Yeah.
And there's plenty, last time I checked, plenty to go around between the Neds, the Archie Roses, the Starwoods, the Gospels, the next whiskey that hasn't even been thought of yet, the Coopers that are coming.
Mm.
Right? Like, the opportunity for Australian whiskey to be the number one whiskey consumed in Australia is huge. I think we're like 2% of the market now. So in my view, there's like 98% to go.
Ammo, yes, I'll admit I'm drinking more Aussie whiskey than Scotch and bourbon.
And guess what? You know, there's a lot of younger drinkers now that don't want to drink what their dad drank.
Yeah.
Right. And has like a, you know, adolescent traumatic experience with bourbon. And so
we've all had that experience. I mean,
bourbon, rum,
Jim, Johnny, Jack, they're very bad men.
Right. So to me, there's a whole generation of drinkers that don't think they like whiskey because of that. I don't like it because it speaks to what my dad drinks and I'm not old enough to be him and what he does. Right. And I don't like it because the taste, which is not the taste, it's just the memory of what happened. Right. Mm. So now it's like it's ripe for us to kind of take advantage of.
So where is what is the future of Starwood now then, looking forward to the next 5 years of expansion? What's the future look like for Starwood?
I think so. There's probably what did I learn from the US to take back to Australia, and you know, take from Australia back to the US, right? Like after having spent some time there. I think the first thing is exactly what I just said. There's such a huge opportunity in Australia. Like, you know, 50, let me get this math straight. It's 4 million nines, so four times, it's 50 million bottles of whiskey are drunk a year. That's not cans, that's bottles. Cans is on top of that. 50 million bottles, right? So we've got a long way to go before we're the dominant player in Australia, and I think we've got every reason to believe we can be if the economic conditions are right, if the government backs this industry the same way they did the wine industry 40 years ago. I don't know if you saw this article, but like I posted something on the Distillers Forum, which was like the top 10 most valuable wine brands in the world. Four of them were French. How many do you think were Australian?
None. Four. Holy fuck.
We have, I mean, the top four were French, right? Yeah. But the next four, I think it went Penfolds, Jacob's Creek, Lindeman's, and Yellowtail are the four. I don't know if that's the order, but I think that that's about right. So four of the top 10 most valuable wine brands in the world are Australian. Now, if you went back 40 years and said, Australian wine brands are going to be the four most valuable wine brands in the world, people would have laughed at you.
Yeah. Yet
here they are. Why? Because the government got behind it. I'm not going to get on my high horse about, you know, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, like the government got hot behind the industry and started to believe. We have every reason to believe that we can be, you know, like some of the most prestigious and rarefied and valuable and sought after whiskies in the world, right? It doesn't have to be just $600 bottles of whiskies that gets us there either, right? There's Penfolds and there's Yellowtail on that list.
Right.
And so everything has permission to exist if the right environment exists for them to kind of thrive, right? There's lots of lessons to learn of what not to do for the wine, you know, from the wine industry, but there's lots there to kind of get excited about in terms of the future. So for me, the future is really bright. I want to kind of redouble our efforts. I mentioned it earlier. I want to be like bigger than Bundy one day. I think we owe it to the country to have like a spirit that, you know, moves beyond something that we can slug down at, you know, when we're 16 and 17 to something that we can kind of have for every occasion. And it's both, you know, something that's drunk south of the border as much as it is north of the border, all that stuff, right?
A national spirit. A national spirit as opposed to a regional spirit.
Correct. So that's my ambition, is to be bigger than Bundy and just be the number one Australian spirit sold around here and around the world, which is something Bundy doesn't do, right? No, we don't export Bundy.
Yeah, right.
Not for want of trying.
Yeah. We can
talk lots as to why
Well, when there is so much good rum around, why would you drink a Bundy?
You're just mean.
I am just mean. And look, as someone who's self-professed, I'm not a rum person. There have been very few rums that I've been able to actually finish a glass. Karoo, Outcask is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Great rum.
And great rum.
Locally by amazing people. They've done such an amazing job with it, and it's a rum that I'll drink 100%. But it's hard for me to name many more of them.
Well, you've got to get some Jimmy rum into you.
Got to get some more. Although the Banks of Solar, I think I actually missed that episode, so I haven't even tried their one. I need to try the Banks of Solar.
So Ian's never tried a Bundy, so what's he missing?
Oh, it's an experience, that's for sure.
Yeah.
The thing about Bundy that I find quite fascinating is Bundy's like comfort food.
Right.
And so when times are tough, when there's an economic downturn or whatever, buyers move to what they gives them comfort, what gives them reassurance, what they know, and they become less adventurous, I would say.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on that, Dave? As far as now, you know, we're in a downturn. There's no question about it. There's a lot of pressure out there, and people, the buying habits are changing. People are holding on to their dollars a lot more.
Yeah, they sure are.
How do you respond to that?
It's very difficult. Like, I mean, you know, because here's the thing, there's not much. It's really difficult for us to compete against Glenfiddich 12-year-old at $75 with Nova, for example, as a single malt whiskey at $100. Just basic economics. It comes back to what I was saying beforehand. It's like, you know what? Like, I don't really fault you for trying Glenfiddich. It's $25 extra. I can't afford to make it any less. If I could, I would, right? I don't know how Glenfiddich's making money because they've got 17 stills in their still house and can kind of get those costs down. It probably costs them more to ship the product than it does to make it, right? Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to compete under that environment. But, you know, it's cyclical crafty, right? I remember like thinking about like the 2007, 2008 sort of GFC and the downturn and all that sort of stuff. And the stock market was a bit faltering. And that was when I had shares. I've only got one share now. It's like in the shape of a barrel. It was like JB Hi-Fi, oof, taking a bath, you know, like on the stock market. But what did you know? You just knew that, like, when things kind of bounced back, that JB Hi-Fi would still be a good business. It's a well-run business. It's a quality asset. And what they were delivering to the customer was compelling, just not right now, right? And so I think that we have to be patient and just see it through if we can afford to. And the challenge is that last bit of if we can afford to. Yeah. And so, you know, all of us, Starwood included, need to cut our cloth to kind of meet the market where it's at the moment, you know. And, you know, that's the old saying of, like, when the wind changes, you've got to adjust your sails, right?
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Like any business, really, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. So that's what we're doing. But, you know, the fortunate thing for Starwood is that we are single-minded focused on making whiskey and nothing else, right?
So no Starwood rum.
No Starwood rum, Ben. Not even in the back shed somewhere, sorry. But we're single-minded focused on one thing, right? Yep. And so when we're not doing the thing, you know, do any of you fish?
I my dad can't fish for shit, so I never caught the bug.
Nor me.
See, my cousin's an amazing fisherman, and if I went to his house right now, he'd be in the garage working on his rods.
Okay.
When you're not doing the thing, you're working on the thing that helps you do the thing.
Yeah.
Right? And so because the saying goes, you know, fishermen tend to their nets when they're not fishing. Right?
Mm.
Yeah.
And the point is that, like, it's easy in these sorts of times to go, okay, shit, let's start thinking about a lower price point product that can kind of take it up against, you know, like, well, let's just kind of, you know, run to the a chase to the bottom and not make any money, but still keep the market that we've got at the moment with these products. Like, no, just kind of let's stick to what we know to be true for Starwood. There's other ways that we can mitigate that. Unfortunately, like, maybe we need to slow down production to kind of keep cash under control. Maybe we need to kind of be smarter about which markets we're kind of investing in versus maintaining, you know, and maybe we need to kind of be more thoughtful about, you know, which products are going to be the ones that get us, you know, that are worth kind of pushing and which ones aren't. So the funny thing is, you know, we've been selling pre-batch cocktails since 2016. So the bottled cocktail, the new old fashioned, was new in 2016. Like, it's the old fashioned now. Like, it's been around for such a long time. Yeah. But, you know, it had a huge boon during the lockdowns. People just loved kind of mixing drinks and bought the pre-batch cocktails and keep it in the fridge. And, you know, it was a competition to see how long it could last in there. Then it kind of went away. You know, there was a bit of a prosperity boom and tailwind of economic growth and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, so that went down, and then, you know, it's back again. So, you know, I'm still long on whiskey for sure. It's just, we've got to be a bit more patient about how we get through it and be smart about the decisions, you know, what we say no to.
Mm.
Yeah, good advice.
Yeah. So taking that under consideration, when you're looking at doing a new release, such as and a small release, such as your Panettone,
yep,
murdered the pronunciation there, or Honeycomb, how do you decide to create something new like that, and then whether you keep it or not?
Mm.
What's the thought process around those sorts of releases?
Yeah. So I think whether I'm the first to kind of here's the challenge. I'm going to go back a step to whiskey drinkers. It's one of the very few spirits categories where you have both people that love whiskey because it's a hobby and love whiskey because of the taste.
Yeah.
But not hobby, right? And so you can have lots of people that love rum, not hobby about it, just love the taste of rum. It's my preferred drink, and this is my drink of choice. Gin, vodka, all of it, right? Just lots of drinkers that are kind of, you got to take from one category to another. Whiskey is a very unique product. Rum kind of has it as well, right? But whiskey, by and far and away, has, like, tragically enthusiastic whiskey drinkers, right? That really curious and insatiable in terms of, like, new and interesting stuff.
Mm. Yep.
So we, because of the way our regulations are written, have an unbelievably unfair advantage in Australia to make very interesting whiskey that other whiskey regions can't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a national duty as distillers to kind of meet that opportunity and come out with wild and wacky shit, ginger beer cask whiskey, like white whiskey that's like 3 years old, all of the things, right? Mm. But the thing, you know, guilty as charged, right? We went through a phase where it was like, Jesus Christ, another release. Well, this is when I'm in the States, like it's coming thick and fast between the whiskey club and like we do other things like Whiskey Loot had one and single barrels, and then we do another one for our direct customers, and it's hard to keep up. I think the trick with that, with hindsight, is you just got to make sure that everything that you're doing ladders up to the thing, right? It's like they are definitely net fixing exercises, if we're coming back to that analogy, and you just need to make sure that it's laddering up to the same thing. So when we start doing things like a bourbon cask release, as much as that was actually going to be another one that I was going to bring up, I actually bought our first ever double cask release in homage to our friends Dave Stewart. Look how many bottles we made. It's kind of funny.
Oh, I can't quite. Hold on. Where are we?
666.
So this is from 2015. One of our first.
At that point, even if you have enough for 667 bottles, you just throw away the rest, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, wastage. It was just in the pipes. So double cask release. So everything needs to ladder up. You got to ladder up the conversation, in our case, to red wine barrel aged whiskey. And so I come along and say, well, what business does Starwood have releasing an ex-bourbon barrel? It's fucking delicious, right? Because of the fruity tropical notes that we have from our Saison yeast and all of, I mean, as a whiskey lover, it is some of the best whiskey we make, right? Because it just shines a light on how amazingly beautiful our new make spirit is.
Yeah.
Right? That kind of clean canvas to paint the picture with.
Yeah.
The bourbon casks give you. And that's why I love bourbon cask aged whiskies, because it sort of is a mind into the distillers. Like you get into the distiller's mind of like what they're intending before it hits the barrel easier than you can with any other product. But what business do we have releasing that when all I bang on about is aged in red wine barrels? On one hand, like our whiskey tragics, that if we sold Starwood toilet paper, would buy it, right? Love the bourbon cask, right? Because it is delicious and it's like the rarest of whiskeys that we have in bond, right? And then if that's your first ever try of Starwood, right, at a mate's place, completely different to this guy here. So you just got to make sure that everything you're doing ladders up to something that you can stand behind that makes it easy for that person to tell the story.
Yeah.
That's the trick. That's the trick.
So anecdote, just a little anecdote. I was over in Scotland. I was over in the UK for a few weeks, managed to get myself over to Scotland. I went to the Port of Leith Distillery, which is an amazing facility. Went up to their bar after doing the distillery tour, just to see what they had on offer. And I was very pleased to see that in very easy reach, not too high above eye level, was Starwood. And it was the ginger beer, the ginger cask. And there was only a smudge left in it.
Yeah.
It was almost gone. Sitting right beside it was the Nova, which only had just a fraction more in it. And I was talking with one of the other tour patrons who was very Scottish, had never heard of an Australian whiskey, had never tried one, of course. I'm like, all right, I'll get you a Starwood. Because we've been talking about it through, and then when I saw it there, I'm like, fuck, this is brilliant. It's there. He was blown away by the ginger. Like, ooh.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's a bit different.
That's interesting. A good way. And then I'm like, all right, well, now we'll move on to the wine cask. Like, I didn't know Australia could do this. I thought you were bullshitting me.
That's what he said.
It doesn't surprise me. We get it all the time. It's like, I didn't even think this was possible. It's the same old, this shouldn't taste good, but it does. That sort of famous quote from Jim McEwan on the Octomore, right? I'm just looking at the comments here. There's a couple of questions from Lord Smeg and Ian. Can I talk about first pour agreements? The wonderful thing is that most agreements don't have a carve out for Australian whiskey. So yes, if you turn up saying we want to replace bourbon with Starwood, then people are going to go, well, I've got to sell Woodford Reserve first, or I've got to sell whatever it is first, right? If we turn up and say, no, keep your bourbon on there. We just want you to kind of have Starwood as a cocktail on the menu or in the rail as well, then all of a sudden there's an opportunity for us to play. So, if you talk to, I actually had breakfast with Will from Archie Rose 2 weeks ago, and it's the same sort of thing, right? Like, it's just like it's hard, but not because of those contracts. It's just hard because it's fucking hard to sell whiskey, right?
Yeah.
But the contracts don't usually get in the way of that. It's harder if you're a gin, I reckon. But Australian whiskey is so different to Scotch and bourbon and Irish whiskey that there's every reason for it to be on there.
There's a few there. Ian's question about the US tariffs.
Yeah.
So for those not watching and listening, so Ian, how much is potential US tariffs going to have on exporting and importing for Aussie distillers and consumers? I've always thought of rum a sibling thought
of whiskey, I think that might be. Tariffs.
The question will be, first of all, whether there will be any tariffs put on Australian imports into the US.
I don't think there's any question on that.
Yeah, that's. I mean, obviously, their focus at the moment. Their nearest neighbours, Mexico and Canada, but I assume that yes, there will be tariffs put on everything.
It won't surprise you that a founder of a whiskey called Starwood has an optimistic outlook. And actually, yeah. I don't think it's going to happen, right?
Yep.
What would be the prudent response by Australia if Australian whiskey was taxed in America with a tariff? What would be the appropriate response?
Tax bourbon.
Who wins from taxing bourbon in Australia?
Well, we do.
We do. The Australian government does.
No, what it means is all of a sudden.
And yes, absolutely. Yeah. We end up with, yes.
If bourbon's 20% more expensive, then we all become 20% more attractive. So I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the likelihood of that outcome is, the Distilled Spirits Council in America is very, very influential, and I don't think that's going to happen. Because it would, there'd be like a retaliatory action across the world, and bourbon's still, I think it's like 35 to 40% of it's exported, which is a substantial volume of it. So I just don't think it's going to happen.
Our main export to the US is actors, though, isn't it?
Say that again.
Our main export to the US is actors. So we'll put a tariff on those.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that and Starwood, of course.
I've got to pick through the comments here. Free trade means we're unlikely to see price. Lord Smeg here saying free trade agreement means we are unlikely to see price hikes from that sector. Global container shipping costs being passed on are more likely to make your imports more expensive.
Yeah, agree. Yeah. Agree.
But, I mean, look, they're inclined to tear up all agreements and do whatever the fuck they want. So who knows what could happen?
Who knows? I mean, this is the thing. I just try and work with the things that I can control, and that's... Yep. Despite my charisma and charm, something that I can't.
So is Asia a focus for you as well?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting market. Like, I had a friend just come back from China. Huge, huge opportunity for whiskey in China, but I think it's going to be Chinese whiskey drunk in China from day one.
Yeah.
So the likelihood of like a Starwood being a huge success, the way I feel like we have an opportunity to be a huge success in America, in China is less likely just because of the domestic environment. Other markets that I'm really excited by, I mean, Taiwan. I don't know if any of you have been to Taiwan, but it's worth a visit just as a tourist. Like, Kamalan's great to visit, but, like, it's just a great city. Yep. You know, there's 25 million people on a very small island, right? Their wealth, it just feels like a country that's progressive and doing well, like Australia is, but just compact and compressed. I kind of call it the Goldilocks between Singapore, which can often feel like a bit of like Disneyland, that, you know, Asia, and, you know, if we're adults and tourists, it's like the Disneyland of Asia, right? And then Hong Kong's like one wrong alleyway, and it's like, oh, we really shouldn't have gone down that, you know. So this is sort of in the middle of that. Really enjoyed my time in Taiwan. I'd go back there in a heartbeat. It's so much fun. Belveni Doublewood is the biggest whiskey in Singapore. It sells huge amounts every year, it was Singleton before that and McCallum before that. So, like, the huge, they don't just drink whiskey, they drink single malt whiskey. That's the number one whiskey, right? Single malt is the number one whiskey category, not blends or bourbons. So that's exciting. I think there's huge opportunity there for that, like, highly engaged whiskey drinker to get involved with something like Starwood. The challenge is that, you know, a lot of that is badge wearing. So we don't have, as a country, the credentials yet that Scotland has as a prestigious whiskey-making country. So a lot of people are buying Macallan for status because they know that everybody knows that if you're drinking Macallan, it's good.
Yeah.
Same with Belveni, all that sort of stuff. So the opportunity for us in that market is more defensive. Like, if there's a pivot away from tradition into modernity, then Starwood's perfect. Right, we're right there. Korea is modern. South Korea is modern and really progressive and, like, adopting sort of Western drinking culture in terms of cocktails and mixology. So that's really exciting. And the rest of them are all, like, probably a little more like Taiwan, but less aggressively so. Like, they're not big whiskey drinking markets, but there's a whiskey market there. So different solutions for different territories.
Yep. What about India?
Untouchable with this tariff system the way it is at the moment. It's just too hard, you know. And this is kind of, you know, coming back to the lessons learned from the United States, is if you don't need to export, given your volumes or aspirations, just hone your skills in the Australian market. Like, the great thing, the best thing that happened out of the American experience for me is what I learned there to apply on being a better distillery in Australia. Right? Because it's so ruthless, because it's so cutthroat, because there's zero fucks given, all of a sudden you've got to mean something apart from just being local and good quality and even reasonably priced, because they've already got that. And so it made me have to work harder to be interesting. And then, like, so now coming back to Australia, it's like, okay, are we really doing ourselves, are we doing the whiskey, like the whiskey is so much more than just, like, well accoladed and local and reasonably priced. So much more on the world stage, you know. I know that to be true. And so when we turn up just talking about this is your local whiskey and it's reasonably priced, it's true, but there's nothing broken with whiskey. So convince me to buy it. Coming back to Crafty's point before, particularly when money's tight, it's like, you've got to convince me to kind of step up a little. If you're not interesting and exciting, and if you can't make an emotional connection with me, be it like going behind the pub and showing him a good time with the whiskey, you know, or coming away from a trip like up into the high country and then sort of landing outside of Yakandanda on the Murray River at Coral. You know what I mean? Like, they're all meaningful experiences that you have, that you're willing to pay a premium for because you're on holidays and you're having a good time. And this is something that's like a memory that I'm going to cherish. Right.
Yeah.
If you're on a shelf, you've got to compete. And you can't, we can't compete with price. We can only compete with storytelling. And, you know, Crafty, you're a master at that in terms of telling, you know, like that whole notion of humanizing whiskey. Right. Yeah. It's just got to, the problem for all of us founders is the sad truth of it is that we have to be repetitively boring to get the message across.
Right?
And so, like, we think that telling a new story every time keeps it interesting. It's just like, no, we've got to be talk about the same thing all the time. It's like, hi, my name's Dave. We make Australian whiskey. It's aged in red wine barrels. We age it in Melbourne. It's famous for four seasons in a day. Have you ever seen the Grand Prix or the tennis? Yeah, the tennis roof's always opening and closing because the weather's so crazy. All that sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Keep it banging on about the same thing all the time, right? And making that connection and honing it and fine-tuning it and getting it right. And it's like, you know, just continuing, you know, continuing to, you know, prune and optimize the tree. So it bears as many fruits as possible.
Definitely good food for thought. And I think a lot of people are going to get a lot out of this conversation. We've kept you for almost an hour and a half. We really appreciate you taking the effort to join us. I'm really glad that we were able to finish off our year. This will be our last episode for 2024. We're signing off for the year.
We are indeed, yeah.
And then we'll be back some point in January, February.
Probably more likely to be February, to be honest.
So definitely make sure you're subscribed on the Facebook, subscribe to the YouTube, hit the like, all those things that everyone says on YouTube. Just fucking do it.
drop us a line and let us know who you would like us to try and interview.
That's it. And if you are a distiller, new upcoming, you've been around for a while and you want to have a yak, feel free to reach out and we'll line you up for a conversation. Dave, it's been fascinating. It's been amazing talking to you as a fan of Starwood. Thank you so much. And as an ambassador to the Australian whiskey industry and scene across the world, I think you're doing amazing things. And thank you for the effort you put in. A bit of feedback as well from those online. Hammo, great interview, guys. Thanks all. And David, Merry Christmas and all the things. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Dave, we really appreciate it. Todd, Crafty, thanks for coming in.
I'm here.
Fuck, it's hot in this little shed. Merry Christmas all and Happy New Year. Dave, hang around. Please, everyone, stay on for our sponsors, and we will catch you all in the new year.
Stay around, guys.
See y'all.